Okay, chairperson gets to briefly qualify. I'm a self-diagnosed alcoholic, and I only use that word really around Alcoholics Anonymous people or Alcoholics Anonymous because it seems to me that most of the world doesn't understand what I'm talking about. And they got another idea of what I'm saying I am, and what I'm saying I am is powerless over alcohol. I got a drinking problem, and it wasn't always this bad. I used to only get drunk when I wanted to. But I cannot drink at all anymore. There's something physically as well as mentally wrong with me. I'm convinced of it. I take one drink and it sets this thing off in me. And one thing for sure, I'm going to get too drunk. And it's gotten to the point I can't hold my liquor at all. I'm in big trouble once I start drinking. And I think I'm at the end of the road. I pretty much used to do about the same pattern of behavior every time I drink. I black out every time I drink, but it's gotten to where I don't think I'll live over another one. And better than that, I don't want to drink. And I think that's the only hope for a guy like me, because I believe that being an alcoholic means that no human power can keep me from changing my mind. And every time I have ever said that I will never drink again, I have drank again. I was sober in AA for 15 months, and I remember telling my sponsor, I can't imagine why anybody would ever drink again. Life is so good, AA is so good, I'll never drink again. I was drunk again not long after that. But so this time I'm very superstitious, and I don't say I'm never going to drink again. But through the grace of God, I believe an act of providence, a guy like me doesn't want to drink one day at a time. This is the only day that matters. I ain't really worried about tomorrow. Tomorrow will be what tomorrow is. But I don't want to drink today, and I believe it's God and AA that has caused this to happen. So I'll shut up now, and it is my great pleasure to introduce the speaker tonight. When I first started coming around AA, I didn't believe that there was such a thing as an alcoholic. Didn't know what the hell it was. Damn sure didn't know that I was an alcoholic. But I met some of the damnedest characters I've ever met. These AA people. And these AA people were describing their problem and telling me what happened to them and what they'd done and what they were like now. And I believed some of them. So that I got a little bit of hope, and then I got drunk again, and I got desperate enough that I decided I'd try to do it. Well, this guy speaking here tonight, he shares his experience and strength with me every time I'm lucky enough to get in an AA room with him, and he shares. And I usually try to catch him after the meeting to get him to talk a little bit more about his experience, you know. And he helps me. God uses him, whether he knows it or not, to help a guy like me. And so here's Paul.
This sure is Bob.
Thank you.
How you doing, folks? My name is Paul, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Paul.
Well, let's see. You know, life for me was pretty normal till about the age of 10. And that's when I had a brother pass away. And that's when my mom started drinking. And it got pretty crazy in my house. And that's really when I experienced this disease for the first time. And so I could get on about what that was like, but those of you that have been there know what it's like. And those of you that don't, consider yourselves lucky, because it was just chaos, total chaos. And it's hard to go to school and focus on the things they want to teach you when your world is shit at home. And school for me was something that I just didn't really connect to. And that's just the way it was. I crossed paths with alcohol when I was about 14 years old, and it really was a special experience for me the first time. I liked it, and I started to use alcohol right from the beginning to get drunk. I don't know if it ever really made me comfortable, but it certainly made me less uncomfortable. And, you know, I would stand out in front of the liquor store in my town, and I would wait till somebody who was cool walked up, and I would give them my dollars and change and get them to buy me a bottle of Orange Tango or Boone's Farm or Southern Comfort, those sweet drinks, and I would drink it as fast as I could, and then it was on, and that's how I drank. And I would stand in front of the A&P and do the same thing if I felt like beer that night, and that's how I drank. And the people I hung around with drank just like me. I didn't hang around with people who didn't drink to get drunk. I hung around with a group of guys, and that's what we did. We drank to get drunk, and that's what started me on that path. And it just became a tool for me to get along in life. And you know, it just was going on and on. And my parents were going to move to Florida. I was probably about 20 years old, and they asked me if I wanted to go. And there weren't a lot of job prospects for a drunk 20-year-old in New York. So I went to Florida, and we moved to Daytona. And same thing, just drank. I was kind of holding it together back then. I do believe I was managing my alcohol. I would work. I put myself through a couple years of college to try to learn a trade, a printer, and life was giving me opportunities at a good life. You know, I met a really great girl. I had a good job. Laura was her name, and I just couldn't hold it together. I would disappear for days on end, and it just got worse and worse. And finally, after a couple years of this, I went my separate way and kind of floundered in Daytona for a little while. And my parents had moved to Orlando, and once again they bailed me out, as they continue to do. And still to this day, if I call my mother, she's there for me. She taught me about unconditional love. And so I come back over to Orlando, and same thing, just drinking and sort of bouncing in and out of different jobs. And I would do jobs where I could drink and smoke weed at work. I started printing T-shirts, and the guy I worked for would have a cooler of beer, and he'd put the T-shirts on top of it. And when I got through the stack of shirts, I could drink a Heineken. And so I became really fast at printing shirts. And that's the kind of jobs I liked. I would just be in my own little space, nobody to bother me, and I would just crank out the product. And I didn't have to deal with people. And so those are the kind of jobs I had. And of course, you know, I was an angry guy, and so every once in a while that would bubble out, and I'd tell a boss what I really thought, and then I'd be looking for another print shop, and that's just kind of how it went. And I think pretty much that's how it went in my family. They knew what was going on, and I was kind of holding it together, but I was still drinking all the time. And, you know, the years are just kind of going by. And, you know, that's T-shirt printing is what I was doing. And I moved to Tampa, and I started remodeling bars. Also a good job for an alcoholic. Yeah. Because I'm there when no one else is. And the alcohol is right there. And so that's how it went. And same thing in relationships. Like, the things that happened to me while I was drinking are just countless. I I went to Greece. I sold a motorcycle. I went to Greece. I met a woman. I moved to Sweden. I married her. I came back from Sweden because she was into Scientology. And, of course, you know, if you asked me at the time, it was everyone else's fault what was going on in my life. You know, I was the victim. So I come back. I meet a girl that I used to date. She tells me she's pregnant. All of a sudden, I'm a dad. 6 years go by, I'm in a lawsuit, it turns out I'm not the dad, you know, just the shit that was going on, and all alcohol related. I mean, as I got into this program and I really learned my role in the whole thing, you know, I had such poor judgment and I was making such poor decisions and I was blaming the outcomes on everyone else, and I was just such a egomaniac and just out of control, and it just went on that way for quite a while. I quit drinking when I was 38 years old, and the way it happened was I was on a bender. I was back in Orlando. I pretty much squandered everything I had, everything of value. I had no car. I'd lost my license from a DUI. I would violation of probation because I, you know, I just didn't want to deal with it. I just started riding a bike so that I could keep drinking. I figured I don't need a license. I can drink without it. And that's kind of how I was going through life. And so I moved back over to Orlando, and this guy lets me stay with him, and it's the perfect setup. I have no responsibilities. I work for him. I get up. We go to work. He gives me money. I go downtown. I get drunk. That's it. On and on and on. And, of course, my parents were always there for me, so I had it in my mind I was going to buy this car, and I talked my father into giving me a chunk of money, and I was off to the races. And I disappeared for a few days. The guy who I was staying with was friends with my father. They had a little talk, and and when I went back to the house, all my stuff, which isn't a whole lot of stuff, is sitting there in the carport, and I'm out on my ass. And I had no, I was so unconscious. I couldn't even formulate thoughts because I had been on this 3-day bender. And I was at my wit's end. You know, I was at the end of the rope, that jumping off point we talk about around here. I was there. And I had it in my mind that I was going to step in front of a bus because I couldn't take it anymore. And this thought came into my mind that if I did this, that my mother would go back to drinking. And I can tell you that my whole family wrote my mother off. The only people who didn't write my mother off are the people in these rooms. And it was a miracle that I witnessed, and I was so pissed that that thought came into my mind. I started cursing God, and said, "Okay, then if you're, then you need to stop my heart. Maybe she could live with that. And if you're not going to do that, then you need to show me another way, because I can't go on like this anymore." And the intuitive thought that came through the fog was to make my way to my parents' house, which I did. I was completely on the other side of town, and it took almost all day to get there. So when I get there, I'm on a 3-day bender. I've just walked like 10 miles. I look like shit, and I knock on my parents' front door, and my dad opens the door, and he says, "You're dead to me." Slams the door in my face. So I hear this squabbling inside, and my mom comes to the front door, and she pretty much tells my dad that either I come in or she goes out. You know, that's a mother's love. And so my father agrees to let me come in and sleep it off. And it's just a miracle. So this is where my life gets really very peculiar, because you got to remember that I asked God to show me another way. And so I'm in my room, the spare bedroom, and I'm sleeping it off. And I tell my mom everything before I sleep it off. I tell her everything I've been doing. For the first time in my life, I owned all my bullshit. And it felt good. And so my mother had said, well, I'll get you into a treatment facility. And that was good for me. Because it was like a little tinge of hope. Like there was a solution there. And so I go to sleep it off. And when I wake up, Laura, the girl I dated 17 years before, is standing there in the living room with my mother. My father's nowhere to be seen. And they proceed to tell me that she had a dream that I was in trouble, and she called my mother, and my mother tells her what's going on, and she comes over because I can't get into the Center for Drug-Free Living for 30 days. So she decides that she's going to, she hasn't seen me in 10 years. She's going to take me back to Daytona and put me up for 30 days until I can get into the Center for Drug-Free Living. And as bizarre as that sounds, you listening to it, it sounds just as bizarre me saying it, and it's always blown me away. But I do believe in God because these are the kind of things that were happening to me. And so I go to Daytona, and I'm white-knuckling it. I mean, that I really did learn what that term meant. What a woman. And so I go to my first AA meeting, and I got to walk a couple miles to get there. And I get about, you know, to the end of the street, it starts raining. But I say, you know, I really need to go, blah, blah, blah. So I walk to this meeting. They meet on Wednesday night. And by the time I get there, I just look like shit. I mean, I'm soaking wet. And I'm there early. And there's this guy standing there. And a young guy, long hair, healthy looking. And he greets me. And he starts telling me his story. And he started carrying the message. And it had a profound effect on me. He is the first person that made me truly feel like this was within my grasp, that I could do this thing. And he brings me into this meeting, not nearly what's in this room, 10 people maybe, introduces me around. I'm probably 2 weeks without a drink at this point, shaking, a wreck. And I sit through this meeting, and there's a raffle. And the person who wins the raffle gets a big book and gives it to me. And so now I have a big book. And they tell me what I tell newcomers, stay to the first 164. And that's what I did. I read the doctor's opinion. I started to truly understand what it was to be an alcoholic. It's amazing you can live with an alcoholic for all those years and truly not understand what this disease is about at all. But living it, I got a whole different look at it. And so 30 days go by. I have to go into detox for 4 days in order to get into the Center for Drug-Free Living. I do this. I get into the Center for Drug-Free Living. And I'm all in. I'm all in. I'm not. There's no gray area as far as whether I'm an alcoholic or whether I want this thing. I'm all in. And so I remember sitting in a room, a circle with some people in this facility, and I remember the counselor saying, 1 in 10 will make it. And I'm in a room with like 22 people, and I'm thinking, well, that only leaves one of them. And I can tell you that the first couple years I came around here, some of those folks were still here. None of them are here anymore. They're all, I don't know where they're at. I hope that they found recovery Having met them, I can tell you that there were a few who needed it, for sure. And so I start hearing the message. I start hearing that I need a sponsor. Got to get a sponsor. And I have no idea what that means, because I can't find the word sponsor in the first 164 pages. And so I'm like, what are they talking about? So I went and got that pamphlet over there. I read a little bit about what it was. And there was a guy who was working at the Center for Drug Free Living, and I asked him to be my sponsor. His name was Daniel. And he said to me that his ultimate job was to help me develop a relationship with my higher power, and that he would become obsolete, and that maybe we would become friends, but that was the nature of our relationship, that he was going to show me what to do. I asked him about the 12 and 12. He told me it was advanced reading and not to concern myself with it, to keep it simple. And I remember the guy who was driving the van for the Center for Drug Free Living. We see him come up here all the time. This guy looked so rough, and he had this job, and he looked at me and he's like, "You're one of them guys that's too smart for this thing. I think you're too smart to get this thing." And boy, was that just like an amber. It just burned my ass that he said that. And I'm glad I was able to dumb it down a little bit. And so that was it. I was all in. I was not playing at this thing. They said, "You do this." I did it. You know, I hear in the rooms people kind of balk on this four step and all this kind of stuff. I wasn't exposed to any of that. I didn't hear any of that fear and don't do this because of this. And I didn't get any of that. So I just jumped right in. And I can tell you now, having been doing this thing I've been coming since August of 98, and I had my last drink in October of 2000. And so, let me see here. Well, I lost my train of thought, so let me take a drink. Well, we can pick up anywhere along there. I started coming here pretty regular with the van on whatever night they brought us. I started going to the old building, met some good people there. A lot of them are no longer with us, and a lot of them, like Bob said, really helped me. You know, I think of Gene, I think of, you know, God, just the list goes on and on. And there were really good people, and a lot of them died sober, and they taught me a lot about living sober. And so here I'm at the Center for Drug Free Living, and I know that I'm getting out, and I'm scared shitless. Because even though I'm all in, there's that little bit right here. And Mom had been coming to see me, and I've been rat-holing 5 here and 10 here. And I probably had about $100 saved up. You know why. And so I go to see Sandy Payne at Ridgewood. Maybe some of you know her. An angel to me, for sure. And Sandy was too busy to talk to me, so I had to talk to Julie. And Julie was her pit bull. And so I take the bus down there, and I tell her I'm getting out in a couple of days, and I need a place to stay. Because left to my own devices, I was fucked. Okay? And I knew this, and I was scared shitless. And she said, "You know, I don't think you're Ridgewood material. I don't think we have a spot for you." And I begged her. I begged her. I cried. I was petrified. And she said, "Well, I'll let you know. When do you get out?" "I'll let you know." And she waited till the day before I got out to let me know that I had a bed. And I was grateful, because there was a 10 o'clock curfew and some structure, and I needed it. And the first day I was out, left unattended, I walked toward a drink. And I had about 65 days at this point, and my feet were almost taking me there. And I figured out what I was doing. I sat down on this park bench. I went to this little tobacco shop. I bought a cigar. I sat down and I thought, maybe tomorrow. Maybe I'll drink tomorrow. But for today, I'm going to try to do this thing. And I did that every day for quite a while. And I was staying over on South Street. And I started walking a mile and a half to Central to get the 6:30 in the morning meeting and a mile and a half home. And I'm staying in this place where there's three bedrooms and three adult men per bedroom in this house. There's nine of us. And some of these guys were what I would call career alcoholics. They had no intention on getting sober, and I was back in the chaos, folks, and it was bad. And I just kept coming here. And life had afforded me the luxury of doing nothing but focusing on my program. It was a blessing. So I would come to meetings. I would go home, deal with the chaos, go to a meeting. And I was at this NA meeting, because in the beginning I would go to both. Because I also do other things and have done other things, and so I was still trying to sort some of that shit out. And it's interesting because when I got here, I remember saying that I was an alcoholic and an addict, and what we refer to as an old timer outside cornered me and said, "You know, Paul, if you say you're an alcoholic and an addict," and the next guy says, "I'm an alcoholic and a gambler," and the next one says, "I'm an alcoholic and an overeater," how are you going to feel if that guy down there living under the bridge who's a hardcore alcoholic comes in here and hears all that shit and thinks he's in the wrong place? And he goes back out there. How are you going to feel about that? I introduced myself as an alcoholic only from then on. That was pretty much it. But I'm in NA and I hear this guy complaining that he can't go to meetings because he's got too much work and blah, blah, blah. And so I cornered him after the meeting and I said, "What do you do?" He said, "I hang drywall." I said, "I can do that." And so I started working and paying my way at the halfway house. $90 a week, whatever it was. Now remember, I have no driver's license. I'm violation on probation, so there's a warrant for me. Trying to walk the walk now. Trying to do this thing that they told me I need to do. And own my bullshit. And so I'm probably about 30 days, saving a little money, and I decide I'm going to call the organization, the probation place, and let them know where I'm at. And let them know that I'm ready to make amends. And the guy starts laughing. He says, "Really? Really?" He says, "Well, you owe $1,200. And where are you staying?" And I tell him, because I'm trying to walk the walk. And he says, "I'll give you 8 days to come up with the money. And if you don't, we're going to put you in jail for a while." Now, I can tell you that it kind of rocked me. And for the first time, I really hit my knees and I prayed. I said, "God, if you want me to go to jail, I'll go. I'm not going to drink again. I've already made this decision. I'm turning it over. If you want me to go, I'll go. But if you don't, I need a job and I need one quick." And once again, God comes to the rescue. My mother had given me a phone so she could call me, and A couple hours later, I'm just sitting on the bed, all in my head, typical alcoholic, I'm breaking rocks, you know? So it's like, I get this call. This friend of mine says, "Hey, Paul, you know, this is Marty. I got a job for you," he says. "I need you to go to Ohio, and I need you to take this printing press apart and put it in a tractor trailer, and when it gets to Florida, I need you to put it back together, but that's a whole other job. The job is go up there, take it apart, put it in a truck. Can you do that?" I said, "Sure. What's it pay?" He said, $1,600. There it is, just like that. So not only do I pay probation and start the ball of getting my license back, I got $400 too. And so I give it to Sandy Payne. Now I'm paying ahead. Take a little pressure off. And so that's pretty much what gets me through. I guess I'm probably still looking for a license. I'm done with probation. I had to do some victim impact panel bullshit, whatever it is I had to do, they had me doing it, and of course I was willing to do it because I wanted a license back. And so Sandy Payne would come over to this house once a week, and that was the only time these people I lived with would clean this house. The rest of the time it was a shithole, and so I would always complain. I'd be like, "Sandy, these people are full of shit," and I would call them out on their shit. And they would all growl at me, and Sandy would look at me, and I would beg her to move to another place. Because she had another place in, I guess, Eola Heights, probably half the distance to Central. And they were one-bedroom places where she put two people in them. And once again, here's where things get kind of weird. I'm coming up here, and I meet this guy named Bruce. Some of you might know him. He's a good guy. And he was living in one of these one bedrooms, and Bruce decided to take his life. He took his life by stepping in front of a bus. It just so happens. And I got his bed. And so that's where I stayed for the remainder of my stay. I put myself at Ridgewood for a year. And it was good, because in the course of a year, I managed to get my driver's license, buy a car. I started making amends. I walked into the IRS and I told them I hadn't paid taxes in 6 years, and they were like, "You're coming in here to tell us this?" Like, "Yeah, I think I owe you some money." And they're like, "No, you look pretty good. Nah, blah blah blah." And then the first time I made a really good hit, and I had a bunch of money coming back, they found a clerical error and took it all. And it was about $6,000. Boom, gone. But then I was even. So, you know, that's what I was doing. I was trying to, you know, I believe that when you owe somebody money and you're making an amends, bring the money. I really do believe that. Because because if they're anything like me, they don't want to hear you're sorry. They want their money. And so I started walking that. I was in Ybor City for all these years, and I would take money and I would just go down there and walk around. And I would just run into people I owed money, handing them back. And that went on for quite a while. And it's funny because amends is a funny thing. Owning your bullshit and being willing to make it right. And I think this is when sponsorship is essential. I think that if not, you're liable to get into quite a bit of trouble. And so, you know, I would bounce stuff off Daniel. He'd say, "Yeah, maybe you want to wait on that," or maybe, "Well, what would you do?" He'd say. "You can't, you know, saying you're sorry is not going to work. What are your solutions? What do you go to them with ideas, three ideas on what you feel is an amend?" And so I would have to formulate these ideas of how I could repay them through actions. And And it was good, because as I went down my list and I would start to think this way, I would come up with ideas, and some of those people I still haven't crossed paths with, but I know that when I do, I know I'm going to handle it. And I'll tell you one amends that's kind of an interesting one. I had this gal I was with for 10 years, and her name was Laurel, and I squandered Laurel. I chose drugs and alcohol over her, and I threw her out. And she was a really good person, and I realized the error of my ways, and I tried to contact this woman, and she wanted nothing to do with me. And I would call a mutual friend, and I would say, "How's Laurel?" I did this for 5 years, and then after 5 years, she says, "Why don't you give Laurel a call? She's ready to talk to you." And so Laurel and I kind of started to mend a relationship. She's married now and living in Atlanta. And when I would go to Atlanta selling art, which is one of the things I did, I would stop by to see her. And I brought the girl I was with, and we would sit down and have dinner. And her husband, Billy, was a raging alcoholic. Raging. And when I first started coming around, he would always make a scene. "She's with me now," all this stuff. It would get real volatile. And I would just, like, suck it up. I would just let him have his way, you know. I mean, I understood where he was coming from. And I thought it was ironic how she picked somebody so similar to me in that respect. And I remember it was like a couple years went by, and Billy asked me about the program. And I gave him the big book that was given to me, and told him the same thing I was told. Stick to the first 164. That's where the solution's at. And call me if you need a hand, and go to meetings. And Billy kind of struggled a little bit, but he managed to put a couple years together. And they were coming down to Tampa, Ybor City, to kick off some friend of theirs who was a writer and blah, blah, blah. So I go down to meet them. Now, Billy's got about 2 years at this point, and I'm probably at like 8 or something at this point. And it was nice to see him, but we were in this bar, and this is where Billy really was active, and so all these familiar people. And the next thing you know, Laurel says to me, "Billy just ordered a beer. It's being put in front of him. What should I do?" So I walk over to Billy and I say, "Hey, Billy, before you drink that beer, can I talk to you out front for a minute?" And we go out front, and I proceed to tell him what would happen to me if I drank that beer. I never told him what to do, never even alluded to it. I just told him what would happen to me. And I told him that the woman inside the bar, who was his wife, that I squandered her and that I chose alcohol over her. And that was it. And so a couple weeks later, I was talking to her, and I asked her why Billy didn't drink that night. And she told me that the reason he didn't drink is because I didn't tell him what to do, that I told him what would happen to me. And then she proceeded to tell me that we were even, that anything I had ever done to her was repaid. And I can tell you, Billy's got about 6 years now, went back to school, his engineering degree, and that's how amends work. Sometimes you just don't know what's coming, and all of a sudden, I tell you this story because I'm not saying look what I did, I'm saying look what God did. I mean, I'm not a preachy kind of guy, and I think you need to find that stuff on your own. I think if you ask, that you will get it. And I think that when I was 14 years old and my mom was in the house strung out, and I was sitting in this tree in the backyard, and I said, "God, help me to understand why my mother does what she does," I guess he figured it takes one to know one. Because I can tell you that any shame I felt, any of that, it all dissolved. And I've been to meetings with my mother, and it's a privilege. And I can tell you that this program has transformed my life. It really has. And the key is for me to get out of my own way. And it's been an honor to talk to you folks tonight. And I wish you all well. Thank you.